Welcome to Inner Workings. I'm Chris Irving. I first met Mike Allred back when I was a student interviewing comic creators for the first time. And, well, to be honest, Madman really had a profound effect on me as a reader and a fan. Then as I got older, as a comics journalist, because I covered Mike many times, eventually doing an academic volume called Conversations, Mike Allred for University of Mississippi Press. We stayed friends over the years, and I'd say about 7 years ago, I started creating Madman merchandise through Kickstarter. Currently, we have the It Girl Madman with a Frank Einstein head and Mad Woman action figures up on Kickstarter. We have 2 weeks left, and I hope to get even more backers so that we can spread more Madman love to the world. Mike debuted in indie comics in the early 90s with graphic music and, of course, his signature comic book Madman, which is this very crazy pop culture existentialist superhero. Madman is not a book that you necessarily read for the superheroics, though those are fantastic and plentiful. It's not only Mike's quirky retro art style or his wife Laura's vibrant colors, but it's more about a character who's trying to find his identity and also grapple with these larger spiritual questions. Mike has admitted in recent times that yes, Frank Einstein, aka the Madman of Snap City, was basically his cipher. It's pretty obvious from anyone who knows Mike. I mean, gosh, you just have to look at him. He looks exactly like Mike Allred. In 2000, Mike made a really bold and unexpected move. Marvel Comics was in the process of shaking things up after getting out of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And Mike was brought on with writer Peter Milligan. Mike went on the X-Force comic book, entirely revamping and re-envisioning the mutant team created by Rob Liefeld, Louise Simonson, and Fabian Nicieza as this really weird celebrity culture reality TV superhero team. At the end of the first issue, all but two members of the X-Force team get killed in front of camera. X-Force was the start of Mike's venture into mainstream comics, and we talk a little bit about that. We also discuss his current work on The Excellent, which is the third volume of X-Force, using some of the same characters, plus many new ones. And we talk a little bit more, of course, about Madman, and he hints at his upcoming projects. This one was really fun to do, but in all honesty, it really was catching up with an old friend. I hope you enjoy. Currently, The Excellent is in issue number 2, and Superman Space Age wrapped up. And we have the It Girl and Frank Einstein figures funded, and we are waiting, as I record this, we are $500 away from unlocking a Mad Woman figure.
Oh, I'm so excited about that. Yeah. I'm so happy you suggested that, because, I mean, that's the coolest way to have a Joe Lombard figure.
Yeah.
So fingers crossed on that. That's super cool.
Thanks, man. Yeah, well, she's been top of my list, honestly. Like, It Girl and then Mad Woman. I love the costume. But I want to ask you about Space Age first, because I have been bemoaning for years how I feel like there's been an absence of great Superman comics coming out of DC. There've been a few like exceptions, but for the most part, I personally just haven't been happy with it. So what were you looking to achieve by doing this Black Label Superman book with Mark Russell?
Well, him and Brittany, our editor, approached me with Mark's initial concept, and for me it was like, yeah. I've been wanting to do a classic kind of evergreen Superman story, like something like, well, All-Star Superman was the last story that really lit me up, but you know, I'm a huge fan of Morrison and then Frank Quitely. And of course what Darwin did with New Frontier. And so lucky for me, Mark lives just a couple hours away and came down and stayed with us, and we just walked and talked all over town.
Wow.
What we wanted to do with it, what our goals were. And again, we really wanted something universal, this overall theme of to really go deep on hope, you know, just what is hope, and what is that, you know, responsibility of having so much power, and how do you live a life in these circumstances, and then tie it in with real world historical events. To have John Lewis in it, for instance, one of my heroes, who I was not just lucky enough to meet, but he gave Laura and I our trophies when Silver Surfer won Best Comic of the Year, and he hugged us. And so to have some of his history implied in there, all of that was really exciting for us to do. As far as just having these relatable historical moments going through three decades, but then also just as always tapping into that little kid fan that is always, you know, bursting biggest in my heart whenever I'm making comics, having all of the other iconic DC characters in there, and even have moments where I just packed it with some real deep cut characters and in crowd scenes and whatnot. It felt like, you know, this is the only Superman story I ever do, and the only significant one I'd really ever done prior was the Madman Superman crossover. So for me, this was like, this is gonna be the one. And that was how I came at it. Everything that Mark wrote just was perfect for me. Just felt right and was inspiring and energizing. So it was just one of those pinch me moments, which I've been blessed to have throughout my career. Like, well, really, I get to do this right now.
Yeah.
So that was really what fueled it.
What did you change your approach to drawing Superman as opposed to when you did him back in the Superman Madman Hullabaloo? Because there's like, I hate admitting this, but it's been about a 25-year gap between both projects. You know,
it's mind blowing.
Yeah.
Like all of a sudden, I still feel like a newbie. It's really crazy. I'm still striving to get better and to reach that level that I've always wanted to be at. And when I did Superman Madman, thrilling a creator-owned character crossing over with the guy, the first superhero. So there's a pinch me moment, but I still was trying to figure out how comics should be made. I was still experimenting and wrestling with it. And so I was also trying to figure out how should I draw Superman. And at that time, what was most important to me was to draw the classic Superman, which, I don't know if you remember, but he wasn't around then. This was mullet Superman.
Oh, was he, or was he electric at that point? I think he may have even been the blue electric Superman.
I honestly don't even remember.
Yeah.
I know that the classic Superman was the only one on the stands when that it was ours.
Yeah.
That Superman was the only classic Superman on the shelves right then. And so that was really nice. And I was just figuring it out. Since then, getting into the Superman or the DC universe more at some point, which I really haven't done. Most of my DC work has been Vertigo work. And, you know, I'll do I would do a little Green Lantern thing here or, you know, and then I was doing all the Batman 66 covers. And then another pinch me moment was when they asked me to do Batman 66 themed covers for every major comic in the line in a single month. So it was like Batman 66 month. And so I got to do all that. And that's when I really got to focus on Superman more for the first time, because several of the covers had Superman on them. And so I was figuring out how I would do Superman. And for me, it's always been the ideal Superman has always been an amalgam of the Fleischer cartoons, Wayne Boring, of course, Kurt Swan, Neil Adams. And there's a couple other artists who I really love how they do Superman. I'm blanking right now, but so I've always tried to find those ingredients with, of course, my style. And I actually did the first cover at least three different times before. I think at least one of them, I think, is in the hardcover, showing that he was closer to kind of a Schuster, Fleischer look. And then I just kind of reworked it until I found my vibe.
Yeah.
And anyway, so yeah, I just kind of had to like figure it out. And then by the time I was, a few pages in, I was like, okay, I'm on it. I'm in the zone.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed seeing kind of the classic Clark Kent. What was your take on Clark? Where did you look to the comics, or did you have kind of a different, a very unique All Red approach to it?
Well, there's always, every artist has to inject some of themselves into everything they do. What I will do initially is just kind of revisit my favorite things. If it's a character I didn't create, or sometimes if it is a character created, we'll revisit my favorite things, and then even then focus even further on my favorite of those favorite things, reminding myself of what I liked about the character. And one of those things was actually the Christopher Reeve performance. Mm-hmm. Always loved his Clark Kent, and then also I loved how with Frank Quitely, how when he would do Clark, I didn't do it to that extreme where he would just all of a sudden be kind of slumpy and whatnot,
yeah,
and performative. But so I just kind of drink all that stuff in, and then I hit the drawing board, and then I don't think about it after that. I really don't. It just becomes instinctual at that point. And so it just spills out, and that's what I enjoy. I enjoy doing kind of the homework or the brainwashing or whatever you want to call it, right? Just, like I just take it in. And then when I start, when I get to the drawing table, because even when I do my thumbnails on the script, it's like shorthand. Most people wouldn't even recognize what I'm, because it's just really quick, like circle, circle, line, right? This character will be this big as opposed to that character. And, so I'm roughing my layouts out. So then when I go to the boards, it's all there. I'm not redrawing stuff. It's sometimes when you redraw things that you lose kind of that initial energy and enthusiasm for drawing it. And because I ink my own work, I'm then able to kind of do that final polish on it. But it's at that point, it's fun to just like if you're in school in the back of your class and you're just doodling in your notebook, mm-hmm. There's just kind of a really nice buzz about that. Just you kind of, and that's what I love about making comics, is just kind of the getting into the spirit of that, the joy of creating this. And not overthinking it, because all of the legwork has been done. I've got the spirit of it from again revisiting favorite things and locking down design, and then And from there, it's, you know, all of that, the legwork is done, and you can just kind of like melt into the drawing board and just let your hand go. That's what I love.
Yeah. And so any plans on doing that you can talk about doing any other big DC characters?
Yeah, we're actually waiting to hear back on a follow-up with another character, and that's probably the most I should say.
Cool. Yeah. No, that's awesome.
But yeah, there's actually I'm very excited about it, and there's also something with Marvel that I'm waiting to hear back on. And again, pinch me. I can't believe I get playing all the sandboxes that I want to play in. I'm so happy that Laura let me make comic books for a living.
You know, I've been hearing you say that for over 20 years by now. I hope you realize, like, you've actually used those exact words. Pinch me, play in a sandbox. And you have not lost that enthusiasm. And it's funny, because, you know, I've talked to, like, dozens of creators, you know, maybe even hundreds at this point. And I don't hear that level of enthusiasm from anyone who's been in the industry past 5 years, usually. Do you feel that doing your own work, like creating Madman and kind of doing work on your own terms, kind of helped let you establish the terms upon which you would do mainstream work for like Marvel or DC?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. If I had come in a traditional route, maybe I would feel beaten down. I don't know. I can't guess, and I don't want to dwell on it. But the fact that my first successes were driven with my own creator own work, frankly, because I didn't know how to get my foot in the door at Marvel. So I did my own thing. And also, initially, I the stuff that was really lighting me up was, you know, Love and Rockets and Charles Burns and Dan Klaus and where these guys were just kind of making up their own rules or not following any rules. And so I just kind of, I just did what I wanted to do and was lucky to have it be successful enough that, you know, they came calling. And so I would get these fun gigs offered, and then I found the joy of collaboration, and super lucky to, you know, right out of the box, I'm working with Neil Gaiman and Peter Milligan, and then more recently with, you know, with Dan Slott and Russell. You know, it's just Mark Russell. I'm so happy that I've been able to work with the people I've worked with, because it helps me grow as a storyteller, getting into the minds of these, you know, amazing talents. Truly, there's not a day that goes by where I'm so happy to be able to do what I'm doing. And also, I love it so much. I want to do everything I can to make sure it doesn't go away. And so I never want to drop that ball. I just keep running with that ball, because if somebody takes it from me, it'll break my heart.
So your first regular monthly mainstream book, X-Force, which you currently have, I guess I would call it the excellent a third act, right? Because you had X-Statics between. X-Force kind of fascinates me. But it fascinated me at the time because, you know, an indie guy like yourself with the style you had, which was very kind of considered very retro pop, you came in and reinvented your style. I don't know if people realize today what a brave, crazy book it was. I mean, you guys were talking celebrity culture through reality TV shows in the first issue. The first issue ends with everyone but, I guess, Hugo Girl and Dupe getting killed. How has your approach to the characters and the work changed with kind of the different approach to celebrity culture that is in the excellent, which is now, you know, more like social media based?
Yeah, it's actually, I'm to be honest, I'm stunned that Peter Milligan isn't more celebrated than he is. He's highly respected, hugely celebrated, but man, this guy has got his finger on the pulse.
Yeah.
And you would think, oh, well, we've done all we could with this whole, you know, celebrity culture thing. And then, oh no, he's so prescient. What he, like, the whole battles going on between these rival superheroes is how many followers they have.
Yeah.
It's insane. And I just always love to get inside Peter's brain. There's just all of this deep stuff. And then at the same time, it's crazy fun. And it can be insanely violent. And I love it. Working with him is always a huge treat. And he's able to find the obvious that nobody else has found. It's amazing.
You know, he did a book that I picked up about an airborne virus that was killing people. And it was a burger book at Dark Horse. And a month later, the pandemic hit. I never picked up the second issue. I don't know if it came out or not. It was an excellent book. No pun intended. But I think Dan Slott, who you worked on Surfer with, which personally is one of my favorite collaborations of yours. I feel like you and Dan, you know, like with you and Peter, you clicked beautifully, but also in a different way. You know,
that's the whole joy of collaboration. It's mixing the chemistry up. You know, you throw these different ingredients in there, and it is going to be different. And I am going to find inspiration in other areas with a different collaborator. Same with Mark Russell, the most recent example. I'm going to find corners in my creativity that I've never, you know, spent time in. And that's the treat. And then when I get to revisit them, I just did a Captain Marvel short with Dan Slott, and we're hoping to do something long term again. But just getting back with Dan on this, it's like hearing a favorite song. Mm-hmm. You know, you haven't heard it in a while, and you wonder, wow, why haven't I listened to that song? Why I love it so much. And it's because you're busy listening to these songs. You know, there's all these other things happening in your life. So when something cycles back in again, you level up. And this Captain Marvel story so there's Marvel Age 1000, so it's this big celebratory book. And we did this Captain Marvel story with the original, you know, green helmeted, thin helmeted Captain Marvel, you know?
Yeah.
And it's such a blast. And when I work with Dan, everybody's different. And everybody approaches things differently. With Neil Gaiman, he will write his scripts like he's writing a letter. Like it'll start like, okay, Michael, I was thinking that, you know, this is, we should start here. And for this reason, and this, and we should be in this setting. And it's like, it feels like a conversation when in fact, it mirrors the conversation. So if I were to have a conversation with Neil Gaiman, the script would mirror that conversation. And then with Dan, he actually calls me, and almost always, right, I generally am never up before noon. I work all night. I just love, you know, where I'm able to, as the night progresses, I just really get into the, you know, this, I can just get into that zone, and I'm just there, and it's this private place. And so I really love working through the night. But because of that, I, you know, will often not be up before noon, but then Dan will call knowing that before I get up. And it's really cool because, so let's say he calls me at 11 a.m., which is a reasonable time to call somebody, right?
Yeah.
But for me, I'm still kind of fuzzy headed, you know? And he tells me a story. It's like story time. So I get a phone call and he'll just tell me the whole story of the next issue, whatever we're working on. And if you know how, you know, when you first wake up, that's a lot of times you will forget what you were dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
But if something locks it in, or if you make an effort to remember, like if a dream journal and you write it down or something, well, there's this really wild twilighty space between dreaming and waking. And so to get this little story hour from Dan is amazing. And I find myself laughing and Laura will, you know, he must be talking to Dan because she can hear me laughing and like, that's a great idea. And so all of the things that he's telling me are kind of getting locked in my head. And I'm visualizing them because I'm in this dreamy state. And so I'm visualizing all this stuff that he's laying out for me. So then when I get the actual script, sometimes the stuff he talked about won't be there. And I'll be like, hey, didn't you, what about this? Weren't we gonna do this? And he'd be like, oh yeah, or I don't remember telling you.
Getting woken up with a story by a very, very funny man that Dan Slott is.
Oh, I love him so much. I don't even have words.
Yeah.
He's just one of the most huggable human beings ever.
Yes.
And he's just brought so much joy into my life. And again, the Silver Surfer has always been a favorite character of mine. And like, why is the universe being so kind to me, you know, to get that phone call from Dan and Tom Brevoort to, you know, offer that to me and
yeah.
to tell me that you're our first choice for this. You know, we really think this will work. And it's like, you had me at Silver Surfer, you know, and then to have it be this amazing thing. There is not a day that somebody doesn't say something glowing and lovely about what we did with Silver Surfer. It's just this gift that keeps on giving.
And you know, that's one of those books that I see on, like, you know, Twitter for however much longer I'll be on that. But Instagram as well, that people who don't, that's like a gateway comic book for a lot of people, I think. I think it's fantastic anytime, especially now, when creators can take a tried and true established character like Surfer, not only do something new with them, but do something new and fresh enough to attract outside readers into comics.
Yeah, I hear that over and over, like this, when I try to turn people into comics, this is when I give them. And the thing, you know, I didn't even have one fill-in on that entire run.
I remember, yeah.
And it was because I was always caught up with Dan. Because he would, you know, he was doing Spider-Man at the same time, which is, you know, priority for Marvel to, you know, had him keep doing that. And so if he was late with the Silver Surfer script, they'd be cool with it. And we were never horribly late.
Yeah.
But late enough that I was always able to keep up with him and never had to, you know, get a fill-in artist to
That's great.
Give me a break.
Yeah.
I was constantly... I just love to be able to, you know, grab that omnibus and just, you know, selfishly take ownership of the entire thing. Now, on the other hand, always a treat if, like on FF, working with Matt Fraction, another amazing blessing. And then to follow that up with working with my brother on that, and then with on Bug, just one party after another. But with Fraction, there was a need for some fill-in artists, and it'd be like, can we get my buddy Joe Quinones? And, you know, so it'd be like, get a fill-in artist, and yeah, baby, you know, it's a treat. And then going back to X-Force, my best friend at the time, Darwin Cook, who, you know, came and stayed with us and super tight and did so many amazing things to inspire and lift me up, and he asked me, pretty much begged me, when you do it, when you need a break, please let me do X-Force, you know? And so, are you kidding? I want to see you do this, you know? So as a fan, I'm able to celebrate this stuff. And then, I mean, Paul Pope did one, you know, Duncan Fragredo. So I love being the villain artist, especially when I get to have the say on who they'll be.
But yeah, so I have this one friend who did stuff for DC years ago. And he was like, well, you know, it's going to take a vacation, but my editor was talking about getting this guy as a fill-in, and I just couldn't let that happen to the book. So, I'm not naming names, but if I were to name that fill-in's name, you might get it. But you mentioned Omnibuy, and I want to come kind of loop back to Madman a little bit. You know, you do have four library editions out. And you're going to go back and actually reprint a lot of the graphic music and graphic music.
First time ever being reprinted and in color.
Wow. Do you get a sense of finality to Madman in having it in this library edition? Or is it getting you to the point where you want to go back to Snap City?
That's a good question. There are still some stories I want to tell, but at the same time, there is kind of a feeling of tying a bow on it.
Yeah.
And what I denied for most of my run on Madman was how much it reflected my life, and that Frank Einstein was always a cipher for me. And there's my inner thoughts and concerns and struggles and existential anxieties flow through Frank Einstein more than any of my creations by far. It's not, yeah. There's no, not even a contest. It's I ultimately admitted, yeah, he's me. But at the same time, I think I've really come to enjoy the collaborations to where it's hard for me to get back to Snap City because it's hard to you know communicate what's in my head, you know, what's in my brain to make it come out of my mouth. But it on the one hand, it's kind of precious to me.
Yeah.
And so I think it's almost become too personal.
Yeah.
And so I'm rather than sharing a lot of those thoughts, I'm more inclined to be protective of them. And there's this one story, intensely personal, that my life could have changed on a dime, where I could have been one of the worst people you would know. But the universe opened a door for me. And Laura, first time I related this experience to Laura, there was a look of horror on her face. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that I have this wonderful wife, this wonderful life, this wonderful family, this wonderful career. And it could have all been something completely opposite because of these circumstances that were in my life and the choices I had to make and with what was in front of me. And I chose right. And when I see people whose lives fall apart and they do hateful, horrible things, on the one hand, it disgusts me. It saddens me that there are human beings in this world that would hurt other human beings. But at the same time, I know that any human being is capable of being a monster. And it's just those circumstances and the choices we make based on those circumstances that either make us a hero or a villain. And Laura keeps since telling me you need to tell that story, And I haven't found the right language. I haven't found the right formula. Yeah. And so that is something that will likely bring me back to Snap City first, because it can easily be integrated into that universe and those and told through those characters. But at the same time, I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
So it's the fact that all these other opportunities just keep gifting themselves, that that things I just simply cannot say no to.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, so like a Silver Surfer or Superman, and it's like, easy choice. This is, yeah. I'm not going to let this go. This is going to be a blast. So that's largely what's kind of keeping me away from Snap City is all of these other, because I'm naturally a very reclusive person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm perfectly happy to just be, you know, there's about 20 family members and friends who I regularly see. We have Family Fridays, and so I'm perfectly happy and content to do that socializing every Friday, and then perfectly content to be in my little creative fantasy world making things, and to be in a house with the most beautiful living being I've ever been aware of. So I'm a happy camper, but I feel like it's healthier for me to do these collaborations, because it takes me out of that reclusiveness.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and then I'm also more likely to accept an invitation to a show or something, because it will be an opportunity to spend time with the people who I'm so grateful for allowing these blessings, but also the collaborator supporting them as well. And, you know, like if it's an event that, say, Mark Russell would be at, or like we're going to be Free Comic Book Day together, or if there's a show that Dan Slott is going to and they want me to be there too, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, I kind of need that to draw me out of my little bat cave of my own making.
Well, it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that, because I think of, you know better than anyone how much I've read Mad Men, right? I mean, I've written about it, and that's the one comic series I've probably read more than any other, like repeatedly read, you know.
And it's, I love you for it.
Oh, well, thanks, man.
It is such a blessing to be able to see all of this over the years through your eyes.
Well, thank you.
This incredibly bright, insightful person, you know, going through this stuff that I made. It's a kick. I love it.
Well, thank you. I'm going to tell you a secret. When I was, because Mad Men really helped me get through some tough times. You know, I wrote about a lot of it, but it is a book that is, you know, so clearly you working through some things, and you must have been in like your 30s, I'm assuming. Were you early 30s when you started Mad Men?
Honestly, don't even think about age.
Yeah. Well, anyways, you were younger, right? Yeah. So it makes sense that you might not want to revisit a character that's so reflective of a place you no longer are in, because I imagine, or I don't know, maybe you can tell me, are you worried that that would dredge up things that you've, you know, kind of put behind you or worked through in kind of your journey as a human being and creator?
No, there's only one thing that I'm ever afraid of reoccurring, and that I my oldest son Han is making a documentary about it, where, yeah, I suffer from these existential eternity attacks. Never been able to describe exactly what this happens, but about every 4 to 5 years this happens to me, and it completely removes me from reality. And a lot of that is addressed in Mad Men, but nothing specific ever triggers it. It's almost like an alarm clock that goes off. and it completely makes me reevaluate all existence and question all of existence. It's horrifying. And my dad was a shrink. You know, Ken Kesey was his orderly at the VA hospital. For people who don't, he wrote One Floor of the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But, anyway, so my whole life has been, there have always been, discussions of everything from therapy to transcendental meditation to, you know, always an awareness of our psychological state, always aware of our mental health and always aware of what our thoughts are. And, you know, it's almost too self-aware. And again, why I love going into my, you know, escaping into my creative worlds. But, at the same time, we all have to deal with reality in the real world, and there's, you know, bills to be paid and things that have to be completed. And, so revisiting my creative work is actually fun to do when I'm given the opportunity to do it. And most of the time I only do it if there's a need, like for a collection, or if somebody wants to, like if you were to say, hey, I want to talk about this issue for this interview, mm-hmm. then of course I would revisit that issue so I know what we're talking about, that sort of thing. But in general, it's always what's next. And my goal is always to have what I'm currently working on to be the absolute best thing I've ever done. And so there's always something to look forward in that way, that this next thing is going to be the best thing. And I'm just going to, you know, everything that I've learned from making these past things is going to help me, because I can then look at, like, a book will then come out. So I get my comp copies and I'll look at it. And even after just a few weeks, it's like, oh, I should have done this, or I could have done this better. And so, well, rather than, you know, struggle with it, I'll then just spill all those new lessons learned into the new work. And then one thing I do, which I would suggest everyone do, is I have these daily calendars. You know, it's a spiral book, and it'll be like, you open it up and it'll be like Monday, Tuesday, you'll see the week. And you can, so I don't keep like a journal in, like, where I'm putting my thoughts and feelings into a journal. But what I do every single day is write down what I did that day. What, like, I finished inking excellent number 9 pages, you know, 8 and 9, you know, it'll say that. And maybe, you know, finish watching, The Righteous Gemstones, you know, or watched, Succession episode 5 today, you know, something just, and so, and I've got like almost 20 years of these, like on a shelf, you can,
wow.
You know, 2006, and then go to July, you know, 17th, and I'll be able to see what I did that day. You know, whether it was, we did a barbecue today, or, you know, it's not like, again, no real thoughts and feelings, details. It will be like, this was today, and then I can look at that and go, oh yeah. And this was the music I was listening to. This was the movies that were coming out then. It might remind me of, I argued with Laura about something, you know, because this happened, or one of the kids fell down, you know, like it. So it'll just be, that's the kind of trigger. It's a healthy trigger where you're reminded of a moment, an era. It's a collection of eras. And so where some people don't, me for instance, don't want to commit to keeping a journal, so I'm taking the time to write down all my thoughts and feelings, which some people do and enjoy, and good, that's great. But for me, it's like I don't want to spend the time doing that, but to at least keep a record of, you know, what I was working on, and if something significant happened. Like, you know, went to see this movie, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So what's on the horizon that you can talk about?
Yeah, what am I? Oh, well, I'm finishing The Excellent. So that, yeah, that's like the only thing I can talk to. I'm almost halfway through a musical graphic novel in the exact same format as the Bowie book.
Cool.
So I'm working on that, but it hasn't been announced yet, and so I can't say what that is, but hugely excited about that. I'm collaborating on that with one of my bestie friends, Professor Ben Saunders.
Oh, good old Ben. Yeah, I talked to him once, and he's just a lovely guy. The work he's done with the Penguin books is phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's amazing. I have a performing stage in our house. Friendly Fridays, we karaoke, and he has a beautiful voice. So see him all the time, and then Brian Hubert. Those are my two besties who I do buddy stuff with. But Ben and I are massive fans of this musical entity, which we're collaborating on, and so far I'm really happy with it.
Cool.
And I've already done the cover for it, and I think it's definitely top five. It may be my favorite cover I've ever done.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's saying a lot.
It's definitely top five, like the kind of thing I'll never sell. I'm not precious about my own artwork because I can make more, right?
Yeah.
But this I want to keep. It's that to me. Like another piece that I'm looking at right now is my cover to the Monkees Christmas album. And it's signed by Mike Nesmith.
He was just a genius, an actual bona fide genius.
Absolutely. So just a really fast, dry wit. Just, solid dude. Just, we saw one of their last performances. My buddy, Brian Hubert and his wife Elizabeth bought us front row tickets to a Monkees show when they did their last tour when it was just Mickey and Mike.
Yeah.
And it was awesome.
I want to give a big thanks to Mike for taking the time to catch up. Currently, we have the Madman, It Girl, and Madwoman action figures up on Kickstarter. You can find them at www.thedrawnword.com. That's thedrawnword. So please back it. Pledge for one of these awesome limited figures. We're really excited to make them. You can currently read Mike's work in the pages of The Excellent. And, what is that top secret project? We'll just have to wait and find out. Have a good one, everyone.